So last week, I was in Austin at the Texas Tribune Festival. It's an annual event that gathers hundreds of speakers and thousands of citizens to discuss the big issues of the day, from climate change to politics. I moderated a couple of sessions. One was with two great journalists from two very different places with two very different briefs. One was Amy Chozick, a national political reporter for the New York Times, and the other was Evan Smith, the co-founder and CEO of the Texas Tribune. The question at issue turned on President Trump's continuous attacks on the press and on truth, on basic facts. Does it affect the way you practice journalism? If so, how? Evan Smith kicked it off.
Well, it hasn't. And to the degree that it's changed, I don't know that it's changed in the way the people who seek to discredit or disown us wanted it to change. They wanted us to stop doing our jobs. All they've done is gotten us to do our jobs more aggressively, right? So it's changed in that respect. I think that if you are told by the president or by anybody else in public life that you're an enemy of the people and that your work is not meaningful or credible, and you believe in the work that you do, as we in journalism believe in public service journalism and accountability, as someone I admire, and I believe Amy admires, the editor of the Washington Post, Marty Baron, said, you don't go to war, you go to work. And I think we in the press have gone to work. And I think that has been a change in that it's forced us to step up our game.
Step up your game how?
Well, I just think you button up your processes. You make sure that everything you do is right and is fair and is thorough and is accurate. Now, I'd argue that everything we always have done has been fair and thorough and accurate. The difference is that the default setting at one point used to be that we were not distrusted, and the default setting now is that we're distrusted. And I think if you understand your enemy, in quotes, because no one is our enemy really, but if you understand the challenge that you face, then you're in a better position to rise up to meet it. And I think that the clarity of the last year for us has been, coming out of the gate, the default setting is people don't trust us. So we have to work that much harder to combat that. And I don't have a problem with that. You know, you play the cards you've been dealt.
I think there's two parts. I think there's the very dangerous discrediting of legitimate reporting as fake news from the very top, our president, who has called me and other reporters third rate. So I think there's sort of this dangerous dynamic going on where there's a loss of trust in legitimate news. But I also think journalists are not great at taking criticism. And I think there are also some legitimate criticisms that particularly grew out of the rise of Trump that newsrooms should and have taken into account. For instance, the elite media. I mean, this sounds like a term thrown around by conservatives, but I think there is something to the fact that newsrooms need to diversify more. You know, do we have enough evangelical Christians in the New York Times newsroom? Religious Catholics, people from the middle of the country, people who didn't go to elite Ivy League schools. It's not just about racial and ethnic diversity, but I think a diversity of opinions in newsrooms. And I think that this election and sort of the rise of Trump catching everyone off guard in the media says, well, we need to understand the country more. And part of that is not only having reporters out in the country talking to people, but also how do our newsrooms better reflect the electorate?
I absolutely agree with that. You know, again, we are in a state, Texas, that went overwhelmingly for President Trump, not by the margin that it typically does in presidential races for the Republican, but it went overwhelmingly for the president. And, you know, if you spend time, as I do, in fake Texas, that is Austin, Disneyland, you can miss the real story. And I think that it is important, as we in our newsroom do, to travel to all four corners of the state, to small towns as well as to big cities, to places where the voices of people are not ordinarily heard in newsrooms,
right,
to collect that input, not to become a vanity press and simply print whatever they tell you.
Well, you've created a new class of position.
We did, actually. After the election, we said we missed something like everybody else missed something, and we did a fundraise around the idea of a community reporter position whose job it would be, among other things, to listen to those kinds of people, to
right,
go out and seek out the input of people out in the world and tell us what they're thinking. Too often the conversation in Texas, at least, I don't make assumptions about anywhere else, is driven by the people in power. It's top down. We listen to the people in power, and that drives our coverage. When the reality is, if you go to communities around Texas, the conversation in the coffee shop may not be the same conversation as in the Capitol. We really ought to be beginning our own work and our own plan for coverage from the bottom up. And that community reporter position is in part to help facilitate that.
I moved to New York, no job, no apartment, stack of clips from the Daily Texan. A few years later, I started working at the Wall Street Journal, and a prominent business editor, I was going back home to visit my parents, and he said, oh, Texas, that's so interesting. Be sure to check out a Walmart. This was a foreign retail concept to the business editor at the Wall Street Journal. I mean, that was 12 years ago, but I think in some way that story stayed with me because I feel like we did cover Trump's voters during the election, but we covered the most extreme, you know, the neo-Nazis of them, and it was like this anthropological, like, oh, isn't this strange group of people who are wreaking havoc? And I think we sort of missed a lot of what was happening.
Even though a lot of people were sent out, they were looking for the wrong thing and asking the wrong question. And to some degree, the question still remains a little bit wrong. I mean, you're not going to get a whole lot more insight into people's lives by saying, so do you regret it yet? Do you regret it yet? 5 minutes later, how about now? Do you regret it now?
Well, can I try on that? Steve Schmidt, the political strategist for many years, now a commentator on cable television, said within the last couple of days here in Austin something that really struck me. He said that too often the conversation is about left and right, where the dividing line is vertical, when in fact what the press missed is that the conversation is actually a horizontal dividing line. It's above that is people who benefited from the system, and below is people who got screwed. And the below-the-line people are not left or right. It's not either or, it's both and. And so that's why the Bernie voters and the Trump voters, both of whom believe that the system is rigged, and both of whom feel some economic dislocation, both of whom feel targeted by the establishment, that's why there was actually a weird common ground. The Bernie people and the Trump people may have had more in common than they did with the other people in their parties by the end of this election. And so Steve's theory is that's where the press missed. They thought that the dividing line was vertical when it was horizontal. I thought that was interesting.
And millions of Obama voters voted for Trump. I mean, the other thing I would say about going out during the election was that we were very driven by erroneous data. And, you know, reporters in the field would come out and say, there's really something happening at these Trump rallies. I covered Obama in 2008. That was a winning campaign. You felt that. I never felt that with Hillary. So I would come back and say, I don't know. I don't feel like I'm covering a winning campaign here. You know, and editors would say, oh, but the upshot gives her 98%. You know, it's over. And so I think that reliance on data and calling the same circle of political pundits versus kind of what you're experiencing on the ground. I mean, people were like, oh, crowds don't matter, yard signs don't matter. But you know what? It turns out that, like, those are gauges of enthusiasm and who's going to vote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although it turns out, I mean, if you look at Nate Silver's work closely, you know, the guru of meta data analysis, he wasn't that far off. Yeah. It was well within the range of error. He would say part of the problem is that political reporters are so attached to their prior experience. It's kind of like every general fights the last war, but there isn't a lot of data actually about U.S. elections. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you go all the way back, there aren't that many of them. So a lot of the indicators, you know, who is supporting him? Is the mainstream supporting him? No. Does that box get checked off? No, not that one either. Not that one either. I talked to David Leonhardt about this before the primaries, and he said, there's just no way. You know, look for Walker, look for Rubio.
Right.
This is where your candidate is going to be. The rest of this, we shouldn't even cover him. It's a waste of people's time.
But the campaign, I mean, their internal data was also wrong. Uh-huh. I mean, in terms of assumptions, I think you're right in that. For instance, when the Access Hollywood video hit, we like immediately wrote stories about how he's already lost women. We assumed all of these things about him, and I think all of our assumptions have been blown up. I mean, I still hear people say, you know, when 2020 candidates are thrown out there, oh, he doesn't have a chance. I'm like, are we really still doing that?
Can you really say that after the election?
Yeah, really one thing very positively learned.
Exactly.
Another thing is we have to stop with the, oh, this time he's really done it, called John McCain a loser. Access Hollywood.
This time
he's
presidential. He's really become.
Oh yeah, well,
You know, so there was a moment. The Katie Turr book about the campaign alternates back and forth between days on the campaign trail and Election Day, and there's a particular date, December 15th of 2015, where they're on the USS Yorktown, and this is the date that the Trump campaign announces the immigration ban, and everybody in the press corps, as she tells the story, is saying it's over, it's over, it's over. And a woman who works for NBC or MSNBC named Ali Vitali, who is an embed at the Trump campaign, starts calling around to people and asking about this. And what she's hearing is actually, yeah, we don't care about that. We're still with him. Yeah. And Katie Turr says that was the day that she began to believe, actually, this guy could win. Mm-hmm. I think that we all in the press suffered from believing our own BS as it related to our perceptive abilities in a race that defied logic and precedent and everything else. At the end of the day, Nothing mattered. Not Access Hollywood, not the Muslim ban, not anything. This was a campaign in which everything we thought we understood about politics turned out not to be true.
So this whole discussion so far has been pretty much focused on what we missed and why we missed it. And in terms of the discrediting of not just the content of the mainstream media, but even the mission of the mainstream media. I mean, he said they're just another special interest. Trump has also essentially said facts are disposable things that do not serve you, so discard them at will. When you're dealing with someone who says your mission has no value, your information is really just an agenda in newsprint, do you address that? And if so, how?
But the fascinating thing about Donald Trump saying all these things is, of course, he gets on the phone and he grants the media more access than I think Obama did, and certainly Hillary Clinton would have. I mean, even as he bashes us, he completely thrives and lives on us. And so it makes everyone sort of question the idea of access journalism.
If the place is leaking like a lobster pot anyway, you don't need access to get that quote that finishes your story. You don't have to make a deal. You don't have to protect them so that they'll return your call. That's a kind of liberation.
Well, but you know, the Trump campaign is in some respects an exception to the reality of what at least we in the states and in Texas particularly might see. You know, I think Amy is exactly right. Trump is in the middle of tweeting how much he hates the New York Times and interrupts himself to call Maggie Haberman. I mean, you know, this is what happens, right? In Texas, we see a different thing. We don't see the hypocrisy of people criticizing the press but then secretly communicating with them. We just see people in elective office cutting the press out entirely. You know, we have a number of statewide elected officials, not everybody, but a number, that just simply, as a matter of course, don't talk to the mainstream press. They go and they do an interview with Newsmax and they say, oh, I've done press. And that's the end of it. And they realize that they can now go around us. They don't need us anymore. They've got channels to communicate directly with the people who they want to reach, which is principally their base, since our elections are not competitive. Right. They only need a subset of the subset. And so that actually has been a major change to the relationship between the press and
what about a reliance on leaks on the local level? Do you get more leaks because of the blackout? Or are you just really seriously at a big disadvantage now because people feel comfortable ignoring you?
Well, we get some leaks, but it's not like scoop o'clock every day at the New York Times.
Yeah.
I mean, the interesting thing, and this happened so much during the campaign when Hillary Clinton's media strategy was essentially, you know, to really say no to everything and go on the Ellen DeGeneres show or talk to Lena Dunham and do friendly outlets. And I think, like, something has to fill that void. So if a local official is not giving you an interview, you've got reporters doing investigative work into them. You know, there was a lot of, and I think there's a legitimate criticism about how much email stories sucked all the oxygen up, but the Times must have had 50 interview requests to Hillary Clinton to talk about the economy, immigration. Yep. I wanted to talk to her about her work in the Children's Defense Fund, and, you know, she thought she was going to win and was being very cautious and is kind of understandably skittish about the media. And so something fills the void when you're not getting access, and often that is, you know, investigative, and access obviously can be a curse.
And the press knows, and readers know, that politicians don't talk to the press at their own peril. Because if your story is going to be told, either we can tell it or you can tell it.
Right.
You choose. If you decline to talk to us, we're going to tell the story, to Amy's point anyway. We're going to fill in that void with investigative journalism. And the story that we tell, which will not include your voice and your perspective, if it doesn't work out well, that's on you for being too stupid to realize that talking to the press and telling your story is a good idea. And so I think we in the press, this is why I come back to the idea that yes, this has changed us, but it has not changed us for the worse. We do journalism. That is what we do. And we do it at all times and with integrity. And I don't feel if we get cut out of the equation or we get distrusted that that disables our ability to do our jobs.
Right. It's almost like you said, it's almost liberating. It's like I think of the Janis Joplin, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. It's like if you're not going to get the interview anyway, you're not worried about, you know, losing access or pissing someone off.
Right.
There are also a bunch of conventions involved in journalism about the kind of language you use. The word lie. That was a word that would never have been used a few years ago. It's used now.
Yeah, I mean, the Times, the word lie is interesting because obviously for months of the campaign there had been these extreme untruths from Trump. But when he had that press conference to talk about birtherism and he said, Hillary Clinton created it and I'm ending it, Dean Baquet and my editors decided that we need to call this a lie. The hesitation is that a lie says intent, and you don't know what's in someone's head. But this is a lie that he started, that he tried to then lie his way out of. And so they made a very clear decision. My colleague Michael Barbaro wrote a beautiful piece, and it fully put this in context of a five-year-old lie that really put Trump on the national agenda with the voters who turned out to be his base. And it was a very conscious decision of the Times. I mean, since then, we've published lists and lists of his lies, cataloging all of these things, and the Washington Post and others have done a great job of fact-checking.
I refer to this as arrested development journalism. This is where an elected official says something, and then immediately Ron Howard's narration pops over. So a governor will say, we've created 3 million jobs in the last 6 months, and you'll hear Ron Howard's voice, no, you haven't.
Yeah.
And I feel like in some respects, journalism is pivoted in the direction of arrested development, where you have a narrator who is audible at all times to effectively fact-check in real time the statements that are being made by people in office. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it definitely represents a cultural shift in newsrooms, right?
It absolutely does.
I mean, I think the difference is politicians have always been economical with the truth, some more than others. I think Trump did it in such a blatant way that it forced us to up our game and actually call these things lies.
You would read a story during the Bush years, say, where the truth-challenged assertion is stated in the first graph, in the lead, and oftentimes the corrections didn't come until after the jump, or in a box called analysis on the same page. My feeling was that this was kind of a covering your ass exercise because of 30 years, 40 years, really, since the Nixon administration, attacks on the media's supposed left-wing bias. And so you go out of your way to create a situation where you can't be charged with that, even though it might not serve the public as well as simply putting that information where it is most useful, adjacent to the assertion that was made. But that went on for decades and decades.
But it's interesting you mention that era, because I don't think we can look at the discrediting of the media in a vacuum of, oh, Trump gave us this, Breitbart gave us this. You have to go back to the way we covered the run-up to the Iraq War and the Bush years, and I think that it was all sort of building this general distrust. But yes, right now we have we're very much comma, which is not true. You know, you see that right away.
Right.
It's a totally different, I think, editing structure.
Completely. It challenges this notion that the appearance of objectivity is how you build trust.
Yes, but let us also say that the press does not have a monopoly on pointing out other people's mistakes. We make plenty of our own. And one of the problems with the press, I would submit, is that we've been too arrogant over the years in printing corrections and in writing wrongs that we, with pure hearts, nonetheless create because we're human and we're flawed and we do make mistakes because everybody makes mistakes. I don't like the fact that the press's instinct is to get its back up institutionally at a lot of moments when it ought to just say, you know what, we got that one wrong. And I think when you go back to the beginning of this conversation where the question of the distrust of the press, part of that distrust is born of our arrogance. And not everybody is arrogant in equal amount, not everybody's arrogant in the same situations, but we need to do a better job of being humble and of owning our mistakes.
And David Weinberger, one of those internet visionaries, said famously that transparency is the new objectivity. If you want to be regarded as impartial or fair, then best reveal yourself. Best explain your process. Let people reverse engineer the reporting, if you can, by posting, the documents that you drew from and doing the reports. I mean, to the extent that you can.
I do think that one of the things that this election laid bare in sometimes uncomfortable ways was how the journalistic sausage is made, you know, and for those of us who were in the WikiLeaks dump, you know, that can be very jarring to people. Like John Podesta had an off-the-record dinner with reporters, but I think at the end it's ultimately a good thing, and David Fahrenthold has been great about this, tweeting out his notes, bringing people into his reporting. I mean, it was always such a, oh, we can't do that, no one can know what we're working on, and
David,
it was
Fahrenthold's
the secret.
Legal pad will save us, right?
Exactly, right. But in a way, I felt like the WikiLeaks was obviously spun in all kinds of ways to make journalism look unseemly, but the more we can kind of bring readers into our process, and obviously it was one thing when we had a print paper every day. Now we have endless amounts of space on the internet to post the documents, to post a PDF of my notes, to post the raw audio of the transcript that we used. I mean, I think that's a gift, and the more you can bring people into your process, the better.
What about the whole project of dealing with the issue of facts or lies asserted and amplified through media that is incredibly fragmented. I mean, we all talk to our own audiences, and it's a real struggle to reach people outside the converted, so to speak. How do you do your job when you know that you can say all this and the very people that you want to reach with this information may never hear it?
There's an Al Franken anecdote. There's an anecdote in the Al Franken book, I should say. He's running against Norm Coleman for the Senate. And he's going to debate Norm Coleman, and he's trying to figure out how to react to Coleman and how to interact with Coleman on stage. And his campaign person, I believe, if I have this right, says to him, play golf, not tennis. Don't consider this a back and forth. You do your thing. I just think we have to ignore all that. I just think we have to do our jobs. I just think we have to stick to the work that we do and don't, I mean, just do your job.
And I mean, Dean Becquet has said this, but our job is not to be the opposition party. I mean, Donald Trump needs a rival, and he's set up, well, he's still sort of running against Hillary Clinton, but he's made the media this foil. And I think it's really important as we're doing our jobs, we're not the opposition party. You know, if the Trump administration has a great policy achievement, we should cover that as well. And I think if you get in a very dangerous dynamic when you set yourself up as an opposition party because parties change and then that's not our mission. And that just, I think, erodes trust even further.
But how do you triage the lies? I mean, don't you have to find the lies that really influence people's lives and drill down on those rather than focus on every tweet and every distraction because he fills the air with shiny objects that reporters can't resist going after like dogs go after squirrels?
Do you resist? I resist.
I do, but I also understand the argument that, forget Twitter, if a president said any of those things at a press conference, you know, if he said that in the Rose Garden, we would absolutely cover it. And so I think that we have to, you know, we have to not spend 10 days on why Anthony Scaramucci was fired, but we also cannot ignore the president's words.
Yeah, right? No, I wouldn't say that. Yeah. But I think that...
But there are people who think, like, he's just tweeting, just ignore it.
Or, you know, when you say... Hey, person out in middle America who's having a hard time, let me tell you what this assertion of fact, which is completely wrong, how this will actually have an impact on your life. I mean, I think that that's the only way that we can reach across that divide.
I think, I mean, you're right, except in terms of this, in this administration, there have not been major policy achievements yet that really impact people's lives. So I think we get very into the palace intrigue and, you know, Democrats have said personnel is policy. There are a lot of personnel stories in the White House, how he's running things.
Well, in fairness, the palace intrigue is pretty awesome.
It's pretty awesome. It's pretty awesome. But I don't think you can go to a guy, you know, you can go to a guy who got laid off from a factory and say, like, you know, Bannon's firing impacts your life XYZ. I don't think much to grasp onto.
Yeah, and I just think the palace intrigue is really fascinating. Fascinating for those of us who follow it. I don't know, you know, how fascinating that is outside of the precincts that hated Trump to begin with. But we only have a minute left for this, yeah. So I wonder if I can do that that thing where I ask you to sort of sum up what all these attacks on the press, how that informs what you do, aside from upping our game and making it better. Because I believe you, but you've said that.
I mean, I also think we have to see the silver lining here. The New York Times has never had higher subscription rate. People are realizing that journalism requires, I'm sure NPR has had donations, so there has been a silver lining to all of this.
Yes, supporting high-quality information has become a political act.
Exactly. But I think Trump's incredibly obvious lies have also, I would hope, made us more aware of the kind of legalese, typical politician untruths. You know, these things that we would either let slide or, as you said, correct in the, you know, 15th paragraph. Are we going to be more on watch? Maybe a more polished candidate who speaks a little bit more in legalese but still stretches the truth. Are we going to be more on high alert to also call these things out?
The big takeaway for me is that there was a period of time there a couple years ago when people coming out of college, the best colleges, not the best colleges, everybody, were not thinking journalism was a good profession for them to go into. And I was worried that we were going to see a talent drain. Everybody wants to go into journalism now. And so in some respects, this environment, I think, has created an entirely new class of people, young people, smart people, who see an opportunity to do public service journalism, and I couldn't be happier about that.
Well, and they can. We've written about that, forgetting his name, but the high school kid who ended up at the White House briefing and has been tweeting religiously and starting his own blog. Right. I think there's kind of lower barriers to entry if that's your interest and you want to go at it.
Mm-hmm. And so you think that this presidency, Trump, inspires people across the spectrum to take on the challenge of journalism?
He's making journalism great again. Isn't that the last line you've been looking for?
Amy Chozick of the New York Times, Evan Smith of the Texas Tribune, thank you so much.
Thanks.
This podcast was recorded at the 2017 Texas Tribune Festival in Austin. To hear more stuff from the festival, go to texastribune.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.